Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 13th of May. Our guest this hour is the author of an important and very gripping book. It's Red Orchestra, the story of the Berlin Underground and the circle of friends who resisted Hitler. Anne Nelson is our guest. Anne is... She's got quite a background. She's an author. She's a playwright. She teaches at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. She's a playwright and a screenwriter, author of The Guys, a play about the post-9/11 experience, which has been produced throughout the United States. Her play, Savages, based on the true story of a court-martial for war crimes during the U.S. occupation of the Philippines, was produced off-Broadway in 2006. She is the author of a number of books. And we'll tell you more about those as we progress here during this hour. She was a war correspondent in El Salvador and Guatemala in the 1980s, and she has also reported from Eastern Europe and Asia, journalism appearing in the New York Times, the LA Times, Harper's, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and she has appeared on the BBC, the CBBC, NPR, and PBS. This is about the Rote Kapelle, the Red Orchestra, the Gestapo's name for a band of German artists, intellectuals, and bureaucrats, almost half of them women, who battled treacherous odds to unveil the brutal secrets of their fascist employers and oppressors. And the story is told through the eyes of a young woman who has connections, actually, as do several of the people in this book, to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we'll talk about this band and who they were and why she chose this woman to tell this story and why people did this. I guess that's ultimately what it is, and how they tried to get rid of Hitler as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or if you'd like to send an email this hour, you can do that as well, and that number or that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Anne. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. What a great book this is. I mean, it's hard to read in many ways, but it's inspirational to read as well. Tell me what it is about this period in history. Was it just a trip you took to Germany and seeing what you saw and wondering about a time in history that was not as fully developed as it should have been? Or was it something that fascinated you as a kid, why people resisted? Where did it come from?
Well, I think that anybody who reads the book can probably tell that I brought this unusual energy in terms of pursuing this topic. And I think that that happens for a writer when two parts of your life collide. One of them is that I grew up in the Midwest, and my dad was from a Swedish farming family. My mom was a German farming family, and they were kids during World War II. So the whole period had this intense interest. You know, I had an uncle at Pearl Harbor who, you know, was a tail gunner during the war. So this was just really the imaginative landscape of my childhood. And then when I went and experienced war, I started asking different questions about World War II than I had before. And one of them was, here I worked in El Salvador, Guatemala, Cambodia, Romania, places with really nasty histories. And in each of these societies, I said, okay, so society divides up, and there are people who support the dictatorship, there are people who lie low and wait for it to pass, and then there are a few people who stand up to it. Why was Nazi Germany different? And I got there and started to dig around and said, oh, it wasn't. There was a resistance inside Nazi Germany. We just haven't heard very much about it. And that's then the chase was on.
Right. And you write in the book about why we haven't heard very much about it. Can you tell me why we haven't?
Yeah, you know, I start to think of it as McCarthyism on both sides. Mm. It's really interesting. If you look at this group of people in Berlin, and when the Gestapo made the arrests, it was over 150 people, and they didn't get everybody. Some of them were Communist Party members at some point in their life, but not the majority. But because of that, in West Germany and the United States, they came to be known as, if they were known at all, as Soviet spies. and tied up into that whole Cold War history, which totally misrepresents what they were about. They provided intelligence to the Soviets. They provided intelligence to the Americans. They were going to do anything that would be effective to work against Hitler. So on the other hand, in East Germany, their own form of communist McCarthyism suppressed anything that was not communist in their history.
Mm-hmm.
So both sides kind of conspired to obscure and erase what these people actually did.
And you tell this story through the eyes, how do you pronounce her last name?
Kukov.
Greta Kukov. Can you tell me, she's a remarkable young woman from the time she's a very young kid almost, and her desire to help the world and help those who are less fortunate. Just weave together her story, and of course in Wisconsin we're particularly interested in her ties to UW-Madison.
Absolutely. She was kind of a working-class Catholic girl from a factory city outside Berlin, Frankfurt an der Oder. And she was smart and wanted to go into a form of sociology. And in the 1920s, she had the opportunity to come and study in the United States. She had an American friend in Germany who said, oh, you know, come on over. It's not that hard. And also, she was a feminist, which I love. You know, she's got a lot of spunk, this woman.
Yes, she does.
And so the German universities, you know, have a tradition of being very traditional, very, you know, somewhat sexist. And she bristled at that. So she came first to New York, and I find this ironic. She was going to go to Columbia, but it was too expensive. I teach there. I agree. So her friends had come to Wisconsin, and they literally just jumped on the train, went to Madison. And she, you know, she eventually became the president of the East German Central Bank after the war. But I've talked to people who knew her, and they said that her time at Wisconsin, she said, was the happiest in her life. It was at the high point of the Wisconsin progressive movement. She was studying the American civil rights movement. She was studying labor unions. And she brought this background of academic German sociology that the Wisconsin professors were fascinated by.
Mm-hmm.
So that she found that she was being treated with respect as a female academic for the first time. And she also was just absorbing American culture. She loved Walt Disney movies. She loved going to parties with black students, and she couldn't understand why the black students and the white students didn't go to parties together. So she was just soaking it all in.
Mm-hmm. She early on recognized that the United States had more than a few problems with racial issues, right?
Well, yeah, and it's so interesting because Weimar Germany was, a poorly functioning democracy, but nonetheless it was. And they had almost gotten to the point of banning capital punishment, whereas she was living in the U.S., when the greatest number of lynchings were taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So she was looking in the 1920s as, you know, the U.S. really has some democratization to do.
Right. Now, she's in Madison when all of these changes are taking place in Germany. There, of course, is intense interest in what's happening, particularly among economists. She studies the economy, and you talked about her being singled out because she is from Germany, and there aren't many people, because the economy is so bad, it's hard for people to get here. But she runs into a German professor who also plays a key role in the Red Orchestra, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. He was a graduate student in economics. His name was Arvid Harnack, and he was in Wisconsin on a Rockefeller Fellowship. He was first cousin to Dietrich Bonhoeffer and from this incredible family of German intellectuals and theologians and doctors. So he was in Wisconsin really studying the American labor movement. So they were the two Germans in this real, it must have been a glorious time in Madison, that's all I can say, because Greta describes in her memoirs how the professors and the students would get together and drink beer and eat peanuts, and just it was all about the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And this energized her, I think, for her work in the resistance in Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the other members, because their stories are equally fascinating. The other members of this Red Orchestra, they became very good friends as well, but they were all over German society. They just were, some of them had very high-level positions in the government, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, one of them was Arvid Harnack's American wife, Mildred Fish, who was from Milwaukee and from an old American family, this beautiful Wisconsin literature professor. But most of the others lived all their entire lives in Germany. One was the son of a very prominent military family. His great uncle had basically remade the German Navy under the Kaiser. That was Harro Schulze-Boysen, and his wife was the granddaughter of a prince. She was an aristocrat who went to finishing schools in Switzerland and Paris, and she was an MGM publicist. So there were others just from every rank of German society. It was an extraordinary collection of people.
And their mission was to gather as much intelligence as they could. One of their missions was, another was to get rid of Hitler, which is an interesting story later on. But they were infiltrating the government and also were trying to help Jews.
Absolutely. I think one of the misconceptions that Americans have about the German resistance is that they were all Johnny-come-lately.
Yes.
At the end of the war. They were losing it anyway. And that's kind of what's bandied about the Valkyrie-Stauffenberg movement, which is not true in itself. But this group, for example, Harro Schulze-Boysen had published a student magazine that was anti-Nazi. And in 1933, the Nazis nabbed him and his Jewish co-editor. They beat his co-editor to death. They beat him into hospitalization. And so he came out in 33 already wanting to defeat the Nazis any way he could. And he decided that the best way to do it was from the inside. He joined the Air Force and was posted to Air Force Intelligence, which gave him this extraordinary viewpoint in military terms. And his one obsession was to get as much military intelligence to the Allies as he could.
Mm-hmm. How is it that all the people who were involved in this, and you can center it as you do in the book about Greta, or from her point of view, how did they think that they were, with very few resources, not many of them, they had a lot of brains, but, not thousands and thousands and thousands of people with them, think that they could take on the massive evils of their time?
Well, what I try to do in this book is really to put myself and the reader in their shoes. And I very consciously don't use the word hero at any point. The way I see them and the way I write it is, you get up in the morning, it's 1933, the Nazis are in power, what do you do? Well, initially you hope that people come to their senses and get rid of them. Well, 2 years later, it's 1935, the Nuremberg Laws, they're hurting your Jewish friends. What do you do now? And so there's this day-to-day logic in their lives. Well, when they start hurting their Jewish friends, they help their Jewish friends. And they don't foresee the Holocaust. Nobody could. But they start forging documents and getting foreign currency and helping the Jews that they know who are being persecuted. And as the Nazis ramp up their path of evil, this group starts ramping up their search for different ways to, I think, first of all, to deter the Nazis' success, but also to help their victims. They were very, very focused on helping people. And that's not a story that gets told about Germany very often.
No, it sure doesn't. Tell me more about the information, who got the information and how it was delivered. And in some cases, there were problems with delivery of information that had been gleaned from the intelligence work, information that was to go to the Americans and to the Russians.
Yeah, I mean, I think one point I keep making is that intellectuals and artists make pretty bad spies. they meant well, but they really would not pay any attention to tradecraft or keeping a low profile. And anyone that they tried to give intelligence to, first the Americans and then the Soviets, would say, you know, stop all of your political activities. And you know, the Americans would say, don't put out flyers announcing war crimes to Germans. And the Soviets would say, you know, don't have any contact with Jews or even German communists. And they would ignore this because of this zeal. So initially, Arvid Harnack and his wife Mildred, as part of the American community in Berlin, had a lot of contacts with the U.S. Embassy and a lot of friends there, and he began to deliver economic intelligence to the U.S. economic attaché. His name was Donald Heath. And so that continued until really the U.S. Closed their embassy and he lost that contact. Mm-hmm. He then had the Soviets approach him. There had been some contact earlier. And they approached him for economic intelligence, and by that time he had contact with Harro Schulze-Boysen in the Air Ministry. So he said, well, I can tell you about the production of ball bearings and import of material and so on. This guy can give you strategic information, which should have been pure gold.
Yes.
The Russian agent recognized this and set it up to get this information straight to Stalin's desk. Then it becomes extraordinary because Schulze-Boysen gave the Soviets a blow-by-blow prediction of how the German invasion would take place. You know, times, routes, everything you could imagine. Stalin had signed the non-aggression pact with Hitler, and he decided to trust Hitler and his word instead of all of this massive evidence he was getting from his entire intelligence service. Mm. So when the invasion happened, the Soviets were caught totally flat-footed, and it really was a dire consequence for the entire world because it really fed the German war machine.
Oh, it's one of those stories you hear and you cringe. What if, what if, what if?
Absolutely.
Oh. Phone calls, we'll start taking them for Ann in a moment. Ann Nelson is our guest, author of, I really recommend this book, it's good, Red Orchestra, the story of the Berlin Underground and the circle of friends who resisted Hitler. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Ann, and let's start with Adam from Phillips. Hello, Adam.
Good morning to you and your guest. I'd like to make about three brief points. But first, I'd just like to mention the fact that I believe the term Gestapo was mentioned. That's an anagram for Geheime Staatspolizei. Germany was a very modern country. That's essentially their equivalent of our FBI, in case anyone wants to know. But my father was a young man from Minnesota, and he was a graduate student at UW-Madison during the time that your guest is talking about. And my father was of German ancestry, and he was absolutely terrified of Adolf Hitler, the new German chancellor. And he tried to convince people on the campus that, they should take this man seriously, and he got really laughed at and ridiculed and poo-pooed for this. And just about the only person who agreed with him 100% was one of his professors in the labor area, by the way, by the name of Professor Selig Perlman, who himself was Jewish, and he was getting letters from relatives in Europe. And then the other thing... Frederick March, one of the most famous Madison intellectuals, writer, and playwright, was actually a member of the Ku Klux Klan in those days. That's how much things have changed. But my second point is that there are many, many attempts to depose and or assassinate Adolf Hitler that came from within Germany itself. Some people put that number at about a dozen. And the last one that almost succeeded is the one portrayed in that movie, Valkyrie. And my last point is that to show how this stuff is still with us today, There's a man named John Demjanjuk who was charged with being Ivan the Terrible, a guard at one of these camps, and he was acquitted of all these charges. But now he's being tried again, which to me is an obvious violation of the provision against double jeopardy of the United States Constitution. And President Obama, who's a constitutional scholar, is letting this take place. I just can't figure it out.
Ann?
Yeah, well, all I can say is that I have a late chapter in the book that talks about the Nuremberg process. And you know, I guess I saw the Spencer Tracy movie, like a lot of people, and said, oh, Nuremberg was this great triumph. What you actually had after 1945 was a very erratic hodgepodge of law, because Nuremberg was driven by the victors in the war, but they didn't complete it. Very few Nazis, including huge war criminals, very few of them were taken to trial in the end and convicted. And then in the late, you know, a few years later, the entire process passed over to the German courts. And, of course, the West German and the East German had totally different processes. And by the early 1950s, it had ground to a halt, and most of the German war criminals had walked free. Well, this case that you're talking about is even more complicated because he was a Ukrainian national working for the Germans. So a lot of, I think, the disjuncture we have is that international law was kind of formed out of World War II in this patchwork process, and it's very hard to create something retroactively. So I would predict more erratic behavior on this front, and obviously it becomes incredibly politicized.
Right. It is amazing, this Demjanjuk story, there's news on it today, that the charges were read against him, 21-page warrant, acting as an accessory to the murder of 29,000 people at a Nazi death camp. It is pretty amazing that this wasn't taken care of completely a long time ago. But you also have this story. Tell the story toward the end of the book about Greta and so many of the people in this small band of brothers and sisters have lost their lives. She's trying to give information, isn't she? I believe it was for people preparing people for the Nuremberg trials, and they just kind of tried to trap her. Instead of getting what the truth was, they tried to label her a communist as well.
Well, what happened was that Hitler had once the arrests of this group happened, the Nazis wanted convictions. So they went to Ukraine, you know, the same region that Demjanjuk was from, and they found an Air Force prosecutor who was called Hitler's bloodhound, Manfred Reuter, and he went into the Nazi courts and basically demanded the death sentence for everybody, even teenagers whose only offense had been putting up stickers on walls. And he in most cases got the death sentences. So after the war, Nuremberg wanted to go after this guy, and in fact one of the prosecutors called him German public enemy number one. Reuter went to the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps and said, I can help you find communists. And the pendulum swung very quickly after 1945. The U.S. Army intelligence people sheltered him for several years, found out that he had no intelligence of any value to offer. Nuremberg tried to go after him again, but then he said, no, I'm under protection of the U.S. Army. So in that way, he not only went back into civilian life, he started campaigning with a neo-fascist, neo-Nazi party and became the mayor of a small town in West Germany.
Oh, my gosh.
And this was around the same time that Klaus Barbie, this is in a footnote in my book, the butcher of Lyon, who put French Jews on trains for concentration camps, did the same thing with the U.S. military. They put him on a payroll. When the French wanted to extradite him, they bought him a ticket to Bolivia and a ticket and sent him into safety. So this chapter was very heartbreaking to write.
Oh, yes. Eugene is next from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. I bought the book Resisting Hitler, Mildred. I got two comments. I bought the book Resisting Hitler and Mildred Harnick and the Red Orchestra, and she just about made it to Switzerland before they caught her. And the second comment is, I've got the book, escaped from Sobibor. And I haven't found, or I haven't looked real close, but I haven't found any mention of that guard that they supposedly guard that they just got done shipping to Germany in that book. And I'm wondering if your guest could comment on the first one, Resisting Hitler.
Yes. Resisting Hitler is a book that's about Mildred Fish Harnack, the American wife of Arvid Harnack. It's by a journalist, Shireen Breistak. And it's a book with really marvelous research. I think that she brings the whole Wisconsin chapter of their life really to light in a very detailed way. So I recommend it. I had an advantage in writing my book a few years after she did. And so in Germany, I think there were some archives that are still being opened from the East. And so everybody that works on this subject has access to more information. And I also dealt with a broader number of the resistance group. I think that people might enjoy looking at both of them.
Yeah. Could you just fill in, we've kind of jumped from the beginning to the end in Greta's story, but can you please, because the book looks through her eyes at much of this, and we went from when she was at Madison, she goes back to Germany. Can you just tell her story for a moment before we go back to calls?
Sure. When she got back to Germany, it was in the late 20s. And, you know, Germany had had such a terrible economic experience after World War One, and it was just struggling to its feet again when the October stock market crash happened in 1929, which has a certain resonance these days. And unemployment went up tenfold, and, you know, the country had just been stabilizing, and then everything was thrown into shock. And that's when the Nazis really got traction. Before that, people just thought they were kind of a goony joke. But people got desperate enough. And, of course, Greta coming back with her Wisconsin ideals was just incredulous that her country could be falling for this. Early on, around the, she had fallen in love with a playwright named Adam Kukoff, and they started living together. Once the Nazis took power, it was a bad time for German feminists because the Nazis said the women's place is in the home, cooking and having babies. So it was very hard for her to work. She and Kukoff had a child in the late 30s. So she made her way and used her mind doing translations. And one of the early projects she did, which would have been in the mid to late 30s, was providing one of the first full translations into English of Mein Kampf. Hmm. There had been one before that was commissioned by the British, but the German government demanded to have say over what was translated, so they took out all the nasty bits, where Hitler was calling in his German edition of Mein Kampf for the mass killings of Jews. The first English edition took that out.
Interesting.
And Greta was saying, no, the Americans and the British have to know what this guy is about. So she translated the whole thing, but she didn't get credit for it. Mm. She kind of helped a man who had the contract but had some drinking problems that prevented him from finishing. So as the resistance activity picked up, she was in this double bind where the men in the group said, you're the mother of a young child. We don't want you as implicated because if the rest come down, you should survive. Mm. And she fought that. She's like, well, you're putting me in danger anyway. Why don't you fill me in on all the details? So I really see this story as including this struggle of a woman to see at what level she participates in this incredible task.
Mm-hmm. And then she also has, I don't want to reveal too much at the end of the book, but it's history too. So she's lost a lot of the members of the Red Orchestra who've been executed. But she, toward the end of the book, you can see that again, trying to find, and successfully so in most cases, the children of those who have been executed or imprisoned, that this maternal and this wonderful kindness about her comes out again.
Yeah, and it was extraordinary because I was able to interview some of these children. And, oh, my God, I mean...
Oh, what a...
Well, yeah, and to interview, well, there's one man whose father and mother were guillotined, and they allowed her to give birth and breastfeed him for a period, and then they were killed. And, you know, now he's an historian in Germany. I mean, these stories are just so moving, and I think it's added to, I mean, certainly in West Germany, members of the resistance and their survivors have been called traitors. And that just blew me away.
Yes.
For decades, people would say, oh, they're the ones that sold out their country. And, you know, you want to say, if they were opposing Hitler, Hitler's the worst thing that ever happened to their country. This is patriotism.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Eugene, for your call. John is next from Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, I think it's kind of timely. I mean, the point of your book is kind of why wasn't there more resistance to Hitler? And, you know, in our country, why wasn't there more resistance to an out-of-control administration in the U.S.? I mean, a war that was not sanctioned by the U.N., torture, shredding of our Constitution. I didn't hear a lot of people in this country complaining about it. But anyway, to go to Germany, though, that was a police state. The majority of people were not Nazis. One-fifth of the army was. I think there was only one election where the Nazi Party got over 40%, and that reversed right after next year. So how did they maintain control? And this is to me, the fascinating question. There were only 40,000, I believe, Gestapo agents in the country, but they had a vast informal informer network. And I just wondered, did you get a feeling for how the German people were kept in control by this police state?
Yeah, that was a question that really engaged me. And I spend a relatively large amount of the book thinking about the media. Of course, my background is in journalism. And so I had exactly that question. Here's 33. The majority of Germans don't vote for Nazis. They aren't Nazis. So what happened? And, of course, Joseph Goebbels, was ready for this moment. He seized control of all the media. And I don't just mean the newspapers and magazines. It was the cinema. It was radio. It was creation of spectacle, such as the Nuremberg rallies. He managed to surround the German people with information that only went in one direction, which was to support the Nazi propaganda. And he managed to pretty much eliminate all sources of information that contradicted it. So one of the big activities of this group was simply to get news. And so, you know, they spent a lot of time trying to get illegal shortwave radios, listening in on the BBC, and then having little meetings in their living rooms, sharing news with people. And then they went to these extraordinary lengths to get illegal mimeograph machines and put out newsletters. And as the war effort went on, the Nazis would say every battle was a huge victory and so on. They stopped publishing that there were any German deaths in battle. You know, and so just getting an alternative reality out there was close to impossible, and many people died in the attempt.
Thank you, John, very much for the call. Tell me about, I'm not sure how many members of the Red Orchestra were involved in the coup attempt, the assassination attempt of Hitler. Can you talk about that? It's in the book.
Yeah. Well, what you had in Germany in general was no single resistance organization. The word Germans use for all of these groups is Querverbindung, which is like overlapping small circles. So the coup attempts were mostly rooted inside the military. And Admiral Canaris and his right-hand man, Hans Oster, led a lot of them. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was involved. And eventually it involved many, many German officers and civilian allies. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, as I said, was first cousin to Arvid Harnack. Harnack and the Red Orchestra weren't directly part of this group, but they were overlapping friendships.
I see.
So that was kind of how it had to be Because remember, the Nazis had banned any kind of meetings or mass meetings. You know, most groups that were involved in conspiracy could only get together in groups of maybe four at a time.
Mm-hmm. And there's, again, what if this had happened? Set the scene in the story of the explosive in the suitcase in a chair that Hitler was supposed to be sitting in?
Yeah. Well, that was the Stauffenberg attempt. And, oh, these officers in the German army had already made all of these previous attempts. And it's heartbreaking to read about. The Germans really believed that Hitler had some kind of psychic powers. And you can almost believe it, because he was supposed to be reviewing a military display, and he'd change his schedule 5 minutes before somebody was ready to blow himself up to take Hitler along. You know, he just would change his plans and evade assassination. So they finally thought they had something that was foolproof. It's depicted with great detail in the Tom Cruise movie Valkyrie, where Hitler was going to be in a meeting room. Stauffenberg brought in a bomb that was in a briefcase. It was placed near Hitler. Stauffenberg left to organize the coup to take over the government. And an aide moved the briefcase to another side of the table leg, which deflected the blow, which was one of the factors that saved Hitler's life. He was wounded, but not killed. And that was July 20th, 1944. Countless lives would have been saved if they had succeeded.
Yes. Art from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks very much for the show. You've mentioned, Mildred Harnack was one of the figures here born in Milwaukee. I don't know if the author is aware. There's by state law in Wisconsin, her birthday is supposed to be a special recognition day, September 16th, in the schools. And there have been some small attempts. Her high school, the Old West Division High School of the Arts, there's a scholarship in her honor and some plaques around the Peace Action Center and Turner Hall, etc. And there was, right after World War II in UW, actually Helen C. White was in charge of a little commission that was set up to investigate how to properly honor Mildred. And then as the Cold War warmed up, suddenly the file just was closed with a note that says, we can't rule out the possibility of communist involvement, and then it just stopped. So one of the things that would be, I think, very good in this state would be renewed efforts to have a more structured honor for Mildred. There's an annual lecture at the law school that Shirley Abramson introduced last time, and various things like that. But there really ought to be a building in Madison or in Milwaukee in her honor and in honor of all three of the members of the Rota Capella who studied and who formed many of their ideas here.
Yeah, and to read these files after the war is just extraordinary. And in fact, I've even seen files from the U.S., you know, McCarthyite investigators that say, gee, there are these people at the University of Wisconsin that want to honor these people. We better investigate the entire university for being communist.
Oh, my goodness.
So they were just so out of control. And of course, the irony was that Mildred was really not, she was a literary figure. She was not really a political person. And I've read a lot of her works. She writes beautifully about Walt Whitman, you know. Now, my position in the book is that there were people who read Marx and, you know, believed in centralized economies. Most of them either suffered at the hands of Stalin or disliked Stalin. And I don't see that if they did things that were positive in the world, we should erase them just because they read Marx and believed in centralized economies. You know, I try to really wrestle with this question in the book and with a measure of common sense.
Kathleen?
Yes, sir.
Not too long ago at the German Resistance Museum, which is basically in the Pentagon in Berlin, they had a display, a tribute especially to Mildred. And there is a high school, Mildred Fischernach Oberschule in Berlin,
huh.
Where the students did artwork in her honor. And that was shown in Berlin and Essen and I think Moscow and Paris. And there was some attempt to bring it here to Wisconsin, but I don't think that happened yet. But if anyone's interested, the Wisconsin Community Fund, we have a fund in Mildred Fischernach's honor to fund the scholarship and other work. The Wisconsin Community Fund based in Madison.
Thank you so much for calling
on. Sure.
Well,
sure.
And yeah, let me just add that I've gotten some archival photos of her, and I'd be happy to share them
great.
With this effort. It sounds like a great thing to do.
Wonderful. I'm trying to figure out how to put you guys in touch, so let me just put Art on hold and let Rob know. I don't know if you're that he's on hold, and we'll get the address and the. Well, we're communicating by email these days too. That might be the easiest way. Great. Thank you. All right. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking with the author of Red Orchestra, the story of the Berlin Underground and the circle of friends who resisted Hitler. Ann Nelson is the author. It has just been published by Random House and highly recommended. 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to send us an email, is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls now. Phil is next from Golden Lake. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Great show. Sent me to my bookshelf for my Brysack book on Arnhem. So I'll look forward to reading your book, too. My question was regarding any connection with the French resistance, or if you might know any good books on that topic. I sure haven't been able to find any, and I think, you know, what you mentioned about the McCarthyism, that may have occurred there, too. I mean, when we found out that François Mitterrand was a collaborator after he was dead, I mean, certainly things were shoved under the rug there. And I've found almost nothing in my visits there. The Chateau de Menthon, the only place I've been where at least somebody from the upper crust was involved, and how much the Count or Duke or whatever he was involved, I don't know, but he was the French prosecutor at the Nuremberg trial. But I can't find any books on him or anybody else.
Yeah, and I have to say that the whole French side of this story, which is not very much in my book, but it was another shocker in the course of my research. And I think the best single thing I've seen on it is the film The Sorrow and the Pity, which was a classic documentary that was made about the occupation of France. And the filmmaker made it, you know, some years ago when he was able to interview the people who participated on various sides. So he's got some fascinating interviews with both collaborators and resistors. And again, I would say that the historical black hole in this is that a lot of people don't want to deal with the reality that there were communists in the resistance. So if you erase them, nothing else makes sense. I would say that would be a great place to start. And one of the great interviews in that film is with a British agent who was parachuted into occupied France. And in this interview, he says, well, you know, it was kind of easier to work with the communists than it was with the other guys, you know, because they were working class and they kind of showed up and did their jobs. The other interesting wrinkle that you could look at is what was going on with Varian Fry and the rescue efforts out of Marseille. And there's some excellent work that about him. And, of course, what you have there is the fact that there were French police rounding up Jews before the Germans ever arrived on the scene. So you had a level of French anti-Semitism that was working directly with the Nazis. So I think that historically the French have gotten a little bit of a free ride. I'll just say this for the record. My email address is ann with an e.nelson@gmail.com.
Oh.
And if you have
Great.
Historical questions, I can probably help you with the research.
All right. Can you give that to me again, Ann?
Ann with an E, dot Nelson at gmail.com.
Nelson at gmail.com. Okay. Thank you so much for your call, Phil. Hannah is next from Ellison Bay. Hi, Hannah.
Yes, good morning. I just wondered if the author was aware of the fact that Mildred Fish was the only American person executed by the woman executed by the Nazis during the war. And I learned about Mildred from Marianne Murphy's fourth grade class at Week School in Walworth County, because she talked about Mildred every year.
Oh, really?
And that's how I learned about her.
Huh.
Yeah, the only American woman executed, yeah, under the order of Hitler, which is, you know, extraordinary. And it is puzzling to me that she's not more of a household name in the entire United States, not just Wisconsin.
Right. Tell me who all you mentioned, the children you talked to, or at least one of them. Tell me who you talked to for this book. Most people are gone here. There were some relations, and you had some extraordinary interviews. I'd like to hear more about them.
Yeah. Well, Hans Coppi was the fellow who was an infant when his parents, Hans and Hilda Coppi, were executed. There was a woman named Erika von Brockdorf, who was a neighbor of Greta Kukoff's, and she was executed, and I interviewed her daughter, Saskia von Brockdorf. John Graudens was an incredible figure. He was a German journalist who at one point was the bureau chief for the New York Times in Berlin.
Mm.
And he worked for the United Press and broke a whole bunch of important stories in the 20s. And he joined this group and was executed. Mm. And I interviewed his daughter, who lives outside Berlin. And these people live very, very quietly. It's not as though anybody honors them at this point. As I said, this whole cloud of what is treason still somewhat hangs over them. And the gentleman before mentioned the German Memorial Museum, the Gedenkstätte Deutscher Widerstand in Berlin, which has really amazing exhibits on this subject. So they've been trying to restore the history. But late in the process of writing the book, I found out there was a survivor of the movement. And she had been a 20-year-old art student in Berlin, and she was Jewish. But the Nazis didn't know she was Jewish, and they gave her, in fact, a scholarship. And when her fiancé's mother and sister were deported to the concentration camp, she was so distraught that somebody noticed and brought her into the circle. And she became a courier and hid fugitives in her studio. And survived the arrest, survived the war, and I interviewed her a year ago, November, in Berlin.
My.
And she's extraordinary.
These stories must be like any other stories you ever hear. I mean, there are some similarities, but what stories you've been hearing? How do you take all this into your heart?
Well, it's been a very long process. I first began the file on it 10 years ago.
Oh, my.
And, you know, there have been so many books written on World War II that you think it's really impossible to say anything new. And yet the further I got into it, the more I said, wait a minute, this is new.
Mm-hmm.
This story has not been told, certainly in English.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, I think it's important. You know, the German term for it is civil courage. And that is a concept that really should be front and center to our thinking. You know, what do you actually do if you're confronted with injustice? And it's quite easy to say, hey, I'll look out for my kids and my family and my career and wait for it to blow over. And sometimes in life, you just can't do that. So I felt that there was a really beating moral heart to this work that I had to honor.
Yeah. Well, you've done it. It's just so well done, too. I must tell you, I was in strange circumstances of watching my son's baseball game while I was reading your book at the same time, and the book won. You know, which says a lot, and I pass it off to my husband, who really is a World War II expert, and it, I hope it does very well. It is just such an important story. It really is such an important story on so many levels. And you're a heck of a writer, Anne. It's
well,
good.
Well, you know, the book has a problem, which is, you know, I said from the beginning, I want to write a girl war book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you go to the World War II shelves, they're very organized according to military campaigns and so on.
Yes.
And books about women in wartime who take action are mm-hmm. very scarce on the ground. So people won't even find this book in the bookstores if the natural audience goes to, you know, the natural places for it. They're really going to have to dig for it.
All right. Well, dig for it, we say. Thanks, Anne, so much. The book is Red Orchestra, The Story of the Berlin Underground and the Circle of Friends Who Resisted Hitler. It has just been published by Random House and highly recommended. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. You're good. You're really good. We'll be with you tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.